It has been too long since I mentioned one of my favorite books, Gilead by Marilynne Robinson. I've recommended it enough that if you haven't read it by now, I'm sure you won't, so I have no guilt in spoiling more of it for you. The book is a series of recollections by the Reverend John Ames, who in old age has taken a wife. He was long a widower and has had a young son. Ames questions his longevity, so he writes to his son so that the child will have some memory of his father. The journal occasions reflections of Ames's own life, his memories of his father and grandfather, who were both clergymen themselves, and the latter of whom was, and this is no understatement, a character. To Ames's grandfather, in the book, he was born in Maine in the 1830s, but moved out west after what could be described as nothing less than a divine visitation. The story goes, in Ames's words, he had fallen asleep by the fire, worn out from a day of helping his father pull stumps. Someone touched him on the shoulder, and when he looked up, there was the Lord, holding his arms out to him, which were bound in chains. My grandfather said those irons had rankled right down to his bones. He told me that as the saddest face and eyed me with that one seraph eye he had, the old grief fresh in it. The vision is a calling like some Old Testament patriarch or prophet, and it spurs the grandfather on to Kansas, where he becomes a John Brown type preacher warrior fighting against slavery. So wondering about the vision that prompted his calling, Ames's father said it was the times. So Ames's grandfather, like an Old Testament prophet, turns out to be a hard man to live with. He steals the family money to give to the poor. He was worse than any thief or house fire, Ames remembers. And so the early novel follows Ames and his father as they attempt to locate the grandfather's grave. As he has finally wandered out on his own into the world, Ames recalls, "My grandfather's grave looked like a place where someone had tried to smother a fire." And the search is a search for reconciliation between father and grandfather. The two never saw eye to eye. John Ames's father remembered his own father as an inflexible zealot. It's revealed that the grandfather once preached a sermon with a bloody shirt and a pistol in his belt. And it's this unresolved history, among other things, that drives the conflict between generations. And so we later hear about the specific cause of the conflict. The two were so often on tenterhooks round each other. "Have I offended you in some way, Reverend?" Ames's father would ask, and the grandfather would say, "No, Reverend, you have not offended me in any way, not at all." And so one day, the family are in church, and Ames's father preaches on the gospel of Luke, "Consider the lilies," and the grandfather stands up and goes out of the church and walks down the road. So Ames remembers the dinner table that afternoon. His grandfather speaks first, "Reverend." His father replies, "Reverend." And his mother, knowing they're about to quarrel, says, "It's Sunday, it's the Lord's Day, it's the Sabbath." And they sit down at the table and the father says, "Did my sermon offend you in some way, those few words you heard of it?" Robinson picks up the story. The old man shrugged, "Nothing in it to offend. I just wanted to hear some preaching." The grandfather indicated he went down to the church down the road. The story continues. After a minute, my father asked, "Well, did you hear some preaching?" My grandfather shrugged. "The text was 'Love your enemies.'" "That seems to me to be an excellent text in the circumstances," my father said. This was just after somebody set fire to the church that was mentioned earlier. The old man said, "Very Christian." My father said, "You sound disappointed." My grandfather put his head in his hands. He said, "Reverend, no words could be bitter enough. No day could be long enough. There is just no end to it. Disappointment. I eat and drink it. I wake and sleep it." My father's lips were white. He said, "Well, Reverend, I know you placed great hope in that war. My hopes are in peace, and I am not disappointed because peace is its own reward, peace its own justification." My grandfather said, "And that's just what kills my heart, Reverend, that the Lord never came to you, that seraphim never touched a coal to your lips." The conflict continues. The grandfather leaves the house, never to return. They never meet again except at that fire-smothered grave. The reference the grandfather makes in the conversation is Isaiah 6. The prophet Isaiah has a vision of God enthroned. The angels surround the throne and sing our opening hymn, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord." And before that, Isaiah is overwhelmed with this sight. His only response is, "Woe, woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips. Yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." It's interesting that his first reaction is not joy or amazement at seeing God, but fear and guilt. His vision of God is also a revelation of his absolute distance from God. God is something so beyond his understanding that to see God is for Isaiah to recognize his own place, his own lowly place in the universe. But in the story, God intervenes. A seraph, that's an angel of the Almighty, descends with a coal from the altar and touches Isaiah's lips. And so now it's the grace of God that's at work in the story that allows someone to speak with God's own words, a borrowed holiness from the one who gives it freely. The experience transforms Isaiah. Instead of being defined by his fear or his guilt, he is ready for the calling God will give to him. And the calling is this: the people of Israel are lost. They once again need a prophet. The king has died. Notice it's God who sits enthroned. The people are in disarray, needing to be reminded who their sovereign is. Isaiah picks up the story. "Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send, and who will go for us?' And I said, 'Here I am. Send me.'" From fear to courage, from hesitation to willingness, from sin to holiness, all because Isaiah is in the presence of God and is touched by something holy. In Gilead, the implication of Ames's grandfather's criticism of Ames's father is that he has never had that transformative encounter with God that will enable him to speak courageously. So the conversation in that story continues. I won't repeat it, but it's simply taken as a given that any encounter with God, and especially a prophet's encounter like in Isaiah chapter 6, will lead to some sort of transformation beyond our understanding. The guilt is blotted out, fear turned into courage, human speech into divine proclamation. And it's that transformation that's the hallmark of any authentic encounter with God. So Isaiah speaks with God's words, Moses with God's law, David with God's authority, Mary with God's child, all encountered by the holy, all changed. So Jesus, at his baptism, named God's beloved Son, is changed too. But as he himself incarnates the transforming power of God, it's the people around him who change. Outsiders and lost souls become a church that bears God's own presence to the world. And it's the transformation that happens around Jesus that ultimately leads his disciples to discover who he is. So Dietrich Bonhoeffer once said something along the lines of, "To know the name Jesus Christ, we first have to know that God's name is unsayable." The ancient Israel did not speak the name of God because it was considered too holy, and that's why the realization of who Jesus is was so challenging. It's why the disciples took so long to understand it, even when it was staring them in the face. And it's hard for us to understand sometimes when we sift through the scriptures. If we understand God to be the Holy One of Israel, who sits enthroned in the heavens with all of the trappings of ancient world royalty and worship and splendor, like in Isaiah chapter 6, to say that we know this God through a wandering Galilean peasant strikes us as an irreconcilable paradox. But it's the encounter with Jesus that changes us, just as surely as the encounter with God changes Isaiah. Something of God's own holiness and love and abundance has come into our own small lives, and the results can be terrifying. Is this what I am made for? Who am I to be addressed or called or changed by God? It's challenging because this is exactly who God is. And it's challenging because through stories like these and through the incarnation of Jesus, we realize that who God is means an awful lot for who we are too. If God isn't content to remain distant, but is the one who calls us and claims us and comes to us as Jesus, that we will be changed and called and challenged just like Isaiah. Isaiah says, "Woe is me, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and yet my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." It's not a question, it's an exclamation, because the implied question has already been answered. So Isaiah could ask, "Why me? Why am I here? What does God's holiness have to do with me?" Maybe somehow he already knows that he has come into God's presence for a reason. He has come into worship for a reason, to be changed, to be joined into God's work of salvation for the people he is called to love in his name. The fact of God is the defining encounter of Isaiah's life. We might have similar questions. What difference does this all make? You could just as easily sleep in on a Sunday. Why should you look for God in worship? What does God's holiness have to do with you? The uncomfortable answer is more than you think. The early church theologian Athanasius put it, Jesus became man that we might become like God. And maybe that's more than we would bargain for from life. We could be content with a life of prosperity or relative ease. But God doesn't seem to care much for that. Instead, God invites us into a relationship so that we might resemble Jesus, the visible image of the invisible God. And that's salvation in the broadest sense possible. It's not the narrow way we often imagine it, as if we do something wrong and the heavenly bean counters weigh it all up in the balance of our lives to determine some post-death reward or penalty. Or if we do the right things, we'll all of a sudden be loved or forgiven or have spiritual experiences that make our lives worth living. That's not what salvation is either. Salvation means joining and participating in something of God's own life wherever we are, and that we can be changed here and now into something resembling God's own life in Jesus Christ. I mentioned Athanasius a few sentences ago, and it's really thanks to him that we have it fully thought out what this means, and that's because Athanasius decided that our best way for understanding God is Trinity. So this Sunday is Trinity Sunday. Following Pentecost and the coming of God's Spirit, Trinity Sunday launches us into ordinary time as an invitation into God's own work and life and being. And it's the observance of this doctrine that fully expresses who we confess God to be. I will not try to attempt to explain what the Trinity is, as if I could. That would not make for much of a sermon. Believe me, Trinity Sunday is hard enough already. But it's important to know that our understanding of God as Trinity has to do with that paradox that Isaiah experienced, that God was both wholly other and wholly beyond his understanding, but also intimately connected with him and concerned with him in all his human life and fallibility. So when we confess that Jesus is God in the flesh, we confess something similar, that the invisible God is seen, the incomprehensible God is known, and we are startled to discover that God invites us into relationship with him. Athanasius gleaned his understanding of Trinity from his reading of Scripture, hoping to counter arguments of those who thought that surely Jesus is a created being, nothing more, a special one, but not sharing God's own life. And so as an aside, this is usually as the way statements of faith are written, not as claims of absolute understanding, but as articulations of faith when we think we're going the wrong way, because what we believe affects the way that we live. But more than that, the Trinity reminds us of the God who is inviting us into relationship and in mission beyond our understanding or deserving. That God is always before us. God calls us and claims us, and God goes with us too. Isaiah doesn't ask for this vision of God enthroned or for the coal to touch his lips or even to share the words of God. That's all done for him. But having seen what he has seen or heard what he has heard, he can do nothing else but respond to God's own yes with one of his own. Here I am. Send me. In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.